fingers again and didn't reply to that. It seemed enough of a confirmation to me, and suddenly a lot of things made sense. Why didn't the superiority field a large number of fighters to destroy my people? Why did I meet so few manned ships or skilled aces during our fights? Why only 100 drones at once? The superiority simply didn't have many fighter pilots. I'd assumed the only way to rule an empire was to have a vast military. They'd figured out another method. If you could absolutely control access to hyperdrives, you didn't need to fight your enemies. It took hundreds of years to travel between planets at sublight speeds. Nobody could attack you if they couldn't get to you. Kuna leaned forward. I am not unimportant in the government here, Alanik, and have taken a personal interest in your people. I consider the Delvers to be a serious threat. If the Urdale provide the pilots I need, I could make everything move smoothly for your people. Perhaps paving the way for your people to be offered primary citizenship. All right, I said. How do we begin? Though I am part of the group planning to fight the Delvers, I am not in charge of the operation. It is instead run by the Department of Protective Services. They are primarily tasked with resolving external threats to the superiority. For example, they are in charge of containing the human scourge. The humans? Yes. I assure you, your old enemies are no threat to you anymore. The Department of Protective Services maintains observation platforms above their prisons and is careful to see that no humans ever escape. Prisons. Plural. Prisons. We weren't the only ones. I held in a shout for joy, just barely, in part because my mood was dampened by the next realization. This Department of Protective Services that Kuna mentioned, that had to be the group we called the Krell. So I was going to be working directly for the Krell? You'll need to pass their tests to become a pilot, Kuna said. They have allowed me to insert a few specially chosen people in the tryouts. You see, there are disagreements among the departments, as we each have our theories on how to best deal with the Delvers. I see your kind as perfect for the duty. You have the martial traditions from your days of unfortunate involvement with humans, but at the same time, you are peaceful enough to be trusted. I want you to prove me right. Try out for the project tomorrow, then represent my interests in the training that follows. If you succeed, then I will personally shepherd your people safely to their citizenship. Kuna smiled again. I shivered at the dangerous way their lips curled. Suddenly, I felt way out of my league. I'd originally assumed Kuna to be some minor bureaucrat who had been assigned to Alanik. That wasn't the case at all. Kuna wanted to use Alanik as a pawn in some political game far beyond my understanding. I realized I was sweating, then wondered how the hologram would represent sweat dripping down my face, or if it even could. I licked my lips, my mouth having gone dry before Kuna's careful stare. Don't stress about their politics, I told myself. You only have one mission, steal a hyperdrive. Do whatever it takes to gain their trust so they let you near one. I'll do my best, I said. Excellent. I will see you at the test tomorrow. The coordinates and instructions are on this datapad, which I will leave with you. Be warned, however, that your cytonic abilities will be muted here on Starsight, and you won't be able to hyperjump away unless you fly out to a prescribed point first, because of our cyto shield. Kuna stood, leaving their tablet on the table. I've included the details about the Delver project on this datapad as well, though specifics on the weapon itself are classified. If you need to reach me before tomorrow, send a message to... Kuna trailed off, then turned their head and flashed their teeth toward the window in a strange sign of aggression. Well, they said, that's going to be a bother. What? I asked. Then I heard it. Sirens. Within seconds, a ship with flashing lights lowered down from the sky to land in front of our building. Let me handle this, Kuna said, and opened the door to walk out. I hesitated in the doorway, baffled. Then I saw the person who climbed out of the ship. It was a human woman. Chapter 11. A human. She was young, perhaps in her early 20s, and wore an unfamiliar blue and red uniform. A Krell climbed out of the ship after her, like an armored knight, though the armor carapace was deep green and crystalline.
What's happening? Embot asked. Are those sirens?
I ignored him and tore out of the building, my hand thrust into the pocket of my flight suit, holding the small destructor pistol I carried there. A human. Scud. I stopped on the stairs, and Kuna moved out in front of me, stepping with a smooth and calm gait. I tried to force myself to relax as the human and the Krell walked up to us.
Oh my,
the Krell said, voice projected from the front of their armor as they made several wild gestures.
Kuna of the Department of Species Integration. I did not expect to find you here. My, my.
I left a specific annotation on the report, Winzik, Kuna said, mentioning the arrival of this pilot. She is from one of the species I've invited to try out for our program.
My, my. And is this our emissary? I did not even know you were coming. You must think us so disorganized. Our departments normally communicate with one another much better than this.
I stepped out from behind Kuna. I didn't need anyone to shelter me, particularly not an alien I didn't trust. But at the same time, one of the Krell, talking directly to me. I knew, logically, that Krell was an acronym for Kitos Redgor Earthen Listro Listrans, the alien name of the police force that watched my people. The race of beings like this one was called the Varvax. I knew all that, but still couldn't help associating these little crabs in the crystalline armor with the word Krell. The human lingered behind and was drawing immediate attention from those around us on the street. While nobody had given me a passing glance during my walk here, a variety of different alien species were gathering to gawk at her and point with tentacles, antenna, or arms. A human, I said.
Don't worry, said Winzik. This human is fully licensed. I am sorry I had to bring her, but, you see, there is an item of much concern. Not that I wish to be forward or aggressive, but an item of much concern we must discuss.
You didn't need to do this, Winzik, Kuna said. The matter is well in hand.
But security is not your duty, Kuna. It's mine. Come, Braid. Let us get off the street and stop making a spectacle. Please, inside. Please.
As before, the Krell gestured in sweeping movements of their arms. Their voice, translated for me, had a feminine tone to it, but I wasn't certain how much I could read into that. I can speak for the emissary, Kuna said.
I must insist, the Krell said. Very, very sorry, but it is protocol, you see. Inside we go.
Scud. The other Krell I'd met on the streets, the ones who had acted so overly pleasing, seemed like pale charlatans compared to this creature. The very way this one moved and spoke, so flowery and with an air of false kindness, was just about the most offensive thing I could imagine. I didn't trust Kuna for one second. I knew they were trying to manipulate me. But this creature made my skin crawl. Still, I stepped back into the building. Kuna stood by the door, impassive as Winzik entered. The human woman finally joined us. She was taller than me by a few centimeters and muscled, with a certain power to each of her steps. She had a lean face that felt a little too severe
for her age, and she wore her hair in a buzz cut. "Braid, test her," Winzik said. I felt a pressure against my mind. I gasped, my eyes widening, and somehow pushed back. "Cytonic," the woman, Braid, said in the superiority language. "Strong." "It is in the documentation," Kuna began. "Her people travel using primitive cytonics, but they aren't advanced enough in their studies to be a danger." "She is still unlicensed," Winzik said. "Your department shouldn't ignore that fact." She is right here," I interrupted, growing annoyed with all of this. "What you want to say, you can say to me directly." Both Kuna and Winzik looked at me with expressions I interpreted as surprise, Kuna pulling back, Winzik making a startled gesture with their hands. Braid, the human, just smiled in a sly way. "My, my, so aggressive," Winzik said, clicking their hands together with a soft sound. "Emissary, do you know the danger you pose to us? To your own people? Do you know that by doing what you do, you could cause great destruction?" "I have some inkling," I said carefully. "Kuna said that you want us to join the superiority so that we would start using your hyperdrives instead of relying on cytonics." "Yes, yes, yes," Winzik said, gesturing. "You are a danger to the entire galaxy. We can help, if your people join the superiority." "And if we don't," I said, "will you attack us?"
"Attack?"
Winzik made a sweeping gesture.
"I had thought you near primary intelligence. Such aggression, my, my. If you refuse to join us, we might have to take measures to isolate your species. We have cytonic inhibitors to stop you from leaving your home planet, but we wouldn't attack you."
Winzik drew their hand to their chest in a gesture that, while unfamiliar to me, still managed to convey their utter horror at the concept. So they were like Kuna, outwardly insistent on peace. I knew the truth.
"Winzik," Kuna noted, "is head of the Department of Protective Services. He has a great deal of experience with isolating dangerous species."
Head of the group that kept my kind imprisoned. In a strange, surreal moment, I realized I was talking to the general of the Krell forces. Winzik didn't seem much like a warrior to me, but I wouldn't let mannerisms fool me. This was the person who ultimately was responsible for the way we'd been treated, and for the death of my father. But why would such an important person be here, dealing with something as minor as Alanik's supposed breach of protocol? I glanced from Kuna to Winzik and wondered if this was all an elaborate charade for my benefit. Kuna showed up, acted nice, and offered me a deal. Winzik arrived with sirens and threats, doing the same. They really wanted to control cytonics. And no wonder. People who could hyperjump threatened the superiority's travel monopoly. Were my powers truly even dangerous, or was that all a sham? I remembered the terrible image of the Delver destroying the humans of Detritus. No, the danger was no sham. But it certainly seemed that the superiority had played off these fears and used them to establish control over the galaxy. The human woman, Braid, was watching me. While the other two made gestures and noises to indicate they weren't being aggressive, she stood with a relaxed air. Her place here was obvious. She was the weapon. If I couldn't be controlled, she'd stop me.
"I need you to promise," Winzik said, pulling a data pad from the bag at his side.
Kuna had used a male pronoun to refer to him.
"No vow. My, my. It must be forceful. You will not attempt hyperjumps near star sight. You must follow the regulations on cytonics. No mental attacks or even prods upon the minds of people here. No attempts to circumvent the shields preventing cytonic jumps in the region. Absolutely no mind blades, though I doubt you are practiced enough for that. And if I disagree, I said.
You'll be ejected, Braid said. Immediately.
She narrowed her eyes at me. Braid, Winzik said. No need to be so forceful. Emissary, surely you can see the need for us to be careful in this matter. Simply give me your word, and we shall take that as enough. Kuna is vouching for you, after all.
Fine, I said. I'll follow your rules.
Though hopefully I would be back to Detritus with a stolen hyperdrive before too long.
See, Kuna,
Winzik said, marking something on his datapad. All you needed to do was bring a proper official with you. Now it's all done right. My, my. Winzik retreated, his human guard trailing along behind him. I watched them go with a frown, confused at the strange interaction.
I am sorry for that, Kuna said, particularly the human. The Department of Protective Services apparently felt the need to send you an explicit message.
Kuna hesitated. Though perhaps this is for the best. It would be good for you to have an ally here among so many strange and new experiences, wouldn't you say?
Kuna smiled again, sending a shiver down my spine.
Anyway, Kuna said, I have assigned you requisition privileges so you can stock this location for your needs. Consider it to be an embassy of sorts, a sanctuary for your kind on Starsight, once we successfully build a new future together. If you wish to communicate with me, send a message to the Department of Species Integration, and I will see to it you receive a quick response. With that, they excused themselves and walked down onto the street, where the crowd had gone back to its ever-flowing stream. Feeling worn out, I sat down on the steps to the building and watched the people pass. An endless array of creatures with seemingly infinite variety. Embot? I asked.
Here,
he said in my ear. Could you make any sense of all that?
I feel like we stumbled into a contest of power, Embot said, and they're using you as a piece in their game. That Winzik is an important official, as important as Kuna. It seems remarkable that either of them would come in person to deal with such a seemingly insignificant race's visit.
Yeah, I said, then looked up from the crowds of people toward the black sky. Somewhere out there was Detritus, square in the sights of superiority battleships.
Come pick me up, Embot suggested. I'll feel safer away from this public launch pad. There should be some kind of wire or connection at the building that will let me access the station's public data net. We can begin looking for information there.
Chapter 12.
My scan is complete, Embot said. I have deactivated the surveillance devices I found inside the building, and I'm pretty sure I found them all.
How many were there? I asked, as I poked around the top floor of the embassy building myself, turning on lights and looking through cabinets as I did.
Two per room, Embot said. One obvious one hooked up to the network. They would likely feign surprise if you complained that you'd found it, claiming it was just part of the automation of the embassy. Then each room had a second on a separate line, hidden carefully near a power outlet.
They'll find it suspicious that we disconnected those.
They might find it surprising that we found them, but in my experience, which is, granted, full of holes and half-memories, this is the sort of thing that we're supposed to politely ignore they did, while they'll politely ignore our interference in their plans.
I grunted, entering what was obviously a kitchen. Many of the drawers and things were labeled. Turned out I could hold my translator pin toward text, and it would read out for me what the words said. One faucet was labeled water, another was labeled ammonia, and a third saline. It seemed this place was set up to accommodate a variety of different species. Embot had been right about the private launch pad on the embassy's roof. Once I'd landed him, I'd plugged him into the data net, and I'd started looking over the building from the top down. I had left Doomslug in the cockpit for now. "I'm taking a general imprint of the data net," Embot continued, "which will hopefully let us mask which information we're searching for, in case they're monitoring our requests. There's a surprising amount on here. The superiority seems very free with information, though huge holes do exist. There is nothing about cytonics, and there are government warnings shutting down any discussion of hyperdrive technology." "It's how they control their empire," I said, "by deciding who gets to move where and who gets to trade. I suspect that if a species falls out of favor, their taxes for travel suddenly go up, or they suddenly find that transports are visiting their world far less often." "You're quite astute with the economics of that," Embot noted. I shrugged. "It's not so different from what the caverns did to my mother and me, preventing us from joining normal society by forbidding us to hold real jobs." "Curious. Well, you seem to be right about how they maintain power. I also found an interesting tidbit about their technology level, specifically regarding holograms. The superiority seems to be about equivalent to your people in that area, and nothing I've been able to find indicates they have access to stealth and holographic technology equal to mine." "So," I said, "no small hologram projectors like in my bracelet?" "No. From what I can determine, they won't even know to watch for what you're doing. As far as they know, that technology doesn't even exist." "Huh. Then where did you get it?" "I have no idea. They hate AIs, though, so maybe I was created to be able to hide. Not just from the superiority, but from everyone." I found that strange, even a little disturbing. I'd assumed that once we escaped Detritus, we'd find that everyone had ships like Embot. "Anyway," he continued, "do you want to get a rundown of what I found about the superiority?" "I suppose," I said. "There are 5 main species leading the government," he said. "3 you're unlikely to encounter. There are very few in residence on Starsight. So we'll leave out the Cambric, the Tanasi, and the Heklo for now. Most relevant to you are the Varvax, which you insist on continuing to call the Krell. They are the crustacean creatures with the exoskeletons. The other species is the Dions. They're the species that Kuna belongs to." "Some are crimson, others blue," I said. "Is that like humans, with our skin tones?" "Not exactly," Embot said. "It's kind of like a gender distinction." "The blues are boys, the reds girls?" "No, their biology is very different from yours. They have neither sex nor gender until they breed for the first time, whereupon they form a kind of cocoon with another individual. It's really quite fascinating. As part of the breeding process, they merge for a time into a separate third individual. Regardless, after breeding, they become red or blue, depending. They can initiate a change in other ways if they wish to be considered unavailable for some reason, while the dark purple color is the skin tone of one who has not mated, or who has broken their pair bond and is seeking another mate." "That sounds convenient," I said. "A little less awkward than the way we do it." "I'm certain, being organic beings, they've made it far more complicated than I just explained," Embot said. "You do always seem to find ways to make relationships awkward and embarrassing." I thought about Jorgen, who must be worried about me, even if he had told me to go. What about Kimmelin, Cobb, my mother, and Gran-Gran? Focus on the mission, I thought. Steal a hyperdrive. Come flying home with salvation in tow, to the praise of my allies and the weeping of my enemies. It was harder to think with such bravado now that I was here, alone, way out of my depth. I suddenly felt isolated, lost,
like I'd strayed into the wrong branch of a cavern while exploring, then run out of light. A scared little girl who didn't know where she was or how to get home. To distract myself, I continued my search of the embassy. My own paranoia made me check each room just in case, and the next one I looked into was a bathroom that had a variety of interesting tubes and suction devices to accommodate different anatomies. There was something impressive and disgusting about it all at once. I left the bathroom and passed back through the kitchen. There were plates and utensils here, but no food. I'd need rations to plan properly. Kuna mentioned requisition rights, I said. Can we get some supplies delivered? Sure, Embot said. I've found a page with nutritional and dietary explanations. I should be able to find something that won't kill you, but which someone of Alanik's race would order, as to not arouse suspicions. Say, some mushrooms? Ha, I was beginning to think you'd forgotten that whole mushroom thing. Once I reprogrammed myself to make you my official pilot, that subroutine stopped running so often. I think my mushroom cataloging impulse must be related to my old pilot's last orders, though I cannot fathom why. Anyway, shall I get you some food? Enough for a day or so, I said. I hope to steal a hyperdrive quickly. Wouldn't it be wiser to stock up, so that you at least appear to be settling in for the long term? Scud. He was obviously way better at thinking like a spy than I was. Smart, I said. Do that instead. I climbed down the steps to the second of the three floors of the building. The rooms here all appeared to be sleeping quarters that had hastily been set up with beds of the type Alanik's species used. Cushioned, with a bed frame that was shaped kind of like a nest, pillows all around the outside. I found one room with large tubs and a closet that had all kinds of ropes and other equipment, which I assumed could be affixed to the ceiling hooks if rooms needed to be transformed to accommodate some form of arboreal species. I'd seen several of those on the streets. Food ordered, Embot said. I got the ingredients raw, as I figured you'd rather make it yourself than trust what you're being given. You know me too well. I'm programmed to notice behavior, Embot said. And speaking of that, Spensa, I'm worried about some aspects of this plan. We don't know what the test to become a superiority pilot will entail. There are very few details in the information Kuna left. I suppose we'll find out tomorrow. Passing a flight test is, I think, the least of our problems. At least that I can do without needing to fake my way through it. A valid point. But sooner or later, Alanik's people are going to grow concerned about the fact that she's not reporting back to them. They might contact the superiority and ask what happened to her. Great. As if I needed more stress about this mission. Do you think we could find a way to send a message to Detritus? I asked. We could relay my status to Cobb and have him ask Alanik, if she wakes up, to contact her people for us? That would be convenient, Embot said, but I have no idea how to make it happen. Then why are you bringing all this up? I snapped. I'm not trying to argue with you or make you upset, Spensa, Embot said. I'm just pointing out realities as I see them. We're in the middle of something very dangerous, and I want us to be fully aware of potential complications. He was right. Arguing with him was like punching a wall, something that I admittedly was capable of doing during my more frustrated moments. That didn't change the truth. I explored the bottom floor quickly and confirmed it was a collection of meeting rooms. After that, I climbed back up to the third floor and the kitchen, which had a window looking out along the street. It seemed so peaceful, with those gardens and people going lazily about their business. Don't trust their peace, I thought at myself. Don't show weakness. Don't let down your guard. I'd been met with nothing but lies since I'd landed here. People pretending they weren't part of some enormous war complex bent on destroying Detritus.
I knew the truth.
I picked up the tablet and scanned the information Kuna had left about the test. As Mbot had said, there weren't a lot of details. There was going to be some kind of mass tryout for the piloting program. Most of those invited were already members of the Superiority, lesser races with secondary citizenship, normally not allowed to serve in the military. Kuna had specifically reached out to Alenik's people for some reason, inviting them to send a representative. According to these details, I was supposed to bring my own ship and be ready for combat. The document said that if I passed the test, I'd be given a superiority starfighter and would be trained to fight Delvers. A superiority starfighter would mean superiority technology. Hopefully, a superiority hyperdrive. I could secretly rip the hyperdrive out of the starfighter, then install it in the space Mbot had for one. And then the two of us could zip home. This was my only way forward. The only way forward for my people. And maybe, somewhere along the way, I could learn more about what I was. And why the Delvers were so interested in cytonics. If the Superiority is preparing a weapon to fight the Delvers, I thought, this mission could be even bigger and more important than we assumed. I had to do it. Isolated or not, untrained or not, I had to make this work. Jorgen said he trusted me. I had to show myself the same level of trust. It began with what I knew best, a piloting test. Chapter 13. The next day, after a night of fitful sleep, I settled Doomslug in the bedroom on an old blanket from my cockpit, then climbed into Mbot and lifted him up off the embassy roof. The piloting test was to take place about a half hour's flight from Starsight, out in space. The details that Kuna had left indicated the coordinates. Local traffic control gave me a flight plan, and I left the city, noticing specifically that I could feel when we got beyond the air bubble and Starsight's cytonic inhibitor. As soon as we passed the invisible barrier, the singing of the stars became louder. A piece of me relaxed, as if putting down a heavy burden. I reached out with my mind, seeking my home, but found only the void of nothingness. I could hear spurts of sound coming from Starsight, their FTL communications bursts, but otherwise I was facing eternity. Even with the prohibitions in place against wireless signals, they still use them, I said, to send flight plans, to communicate with other planets. Yes, Mbot said. The data net is full of warnings about minimizing wireless communications. But it feels similar to how they have warnings to deposit waste in recycling receptacles. There's an understanding that they need to be careful, but also an understanding that a civilization cannot function without communications. The Delvers haven't attacked in decades, maybe centuries, I said. I can see how people would grow laxer and laxer over time. Perhaps that was why Kuna was so worried about Delvers now. Of course, Kuna had also said that mere communications wouldn't pull a Delver into our realm. That required cytonics. Wireless signals merely guided the Delvers to locations once they were already in our realm. I turned, steering us in the proper direction for the test. We joined a group of some 40 other ships that were going the same way, though I could see more groups ahead of ours. A few of the ships looked similar to what I was accustomed to, with what I could recognize as wings. But others were simply long tubes, or bricks, or more seemingly impossible designs. These had been constructed without regard for air resistance. Mbot's quick scan showed that some were fighters, but many seemed more like small cargo ships or private shuttles with no weaponry. Still, all those blips on my proximity sensors struck me as strange. I was accustomed to looking at our sensors and seeing one of two things, Krell or DDF. Civilian traffic was almost non-existent on Detritus. I found no way to communicate with Detritus, Mbot said. Unless you learn to do it with your powers.
However, the requisition privileges you were given by Kuna allow you to use their communications networks to send messages to Alanik's people, if you'd like.
Could we say something to them that wouldn't be suspicious?
I don't know, Embot said, but I found an encryption key among the files I downloaded from her ship. Sending something bland, but with a hidden encoded message, might persuade the Urdale that the message is authentic.
It might seem suspicious to the superiority, I said. They'd expect Alanik to communicate cytonically, like she did reaching out to me. But I guess we could tell them we're trying their network because we want to start testing out their safer methods. They'd probably like that.
I thought for a few minutes as we flew. Alanik's people asking too many questions could be dangerous, and they'd certainly begin to wonder why they didn't hear from their pilot. At the same time, I doubted I could fool them into thinking I was her. Imitating Alanik to a bunch of people who didn't know her was one thing, but trying to do it, even via written message, to those who knew her best?
Will the superiority be able to decrypt the message if we use Alanik's key?
Highly unlikely, Embot said. This encryption is a variation on a one-time pad. Even I would have trouble breaking it via brute force.
I took a deep breath. All right. Compose some bland message about me having landed and everything being good. I'm going to the test today, blah, blah. But underneath that, send an encrypted message. I am not Alanik. She crashed on my planet and is wounded. I am trying to complete her mission.
All right, Embot said. Let's hope that doesn't immediately make them panic and contact the superiority, demanding answers.
It could do just that, but I figured that sending the message was less risky than staying silent.
I have composed the fluffy message to dispatch over the top of the hidden one, Embot said. But since in that one you'll be lying to fool the superiority and saying you're Alanik, you'll have to sign it yourself. I can't write the part that is untrue, as my programming forbids me from lying.
I've heard you say things that are untrue before.
In jest, Embot said. This is different.
You're a stealth fighter, I said. You are literally wearing a hologram to lie about what you look like to everyone who sees us. You're capable of lying.
He didn't reply, so I sighed and typed out Alanik's name at the end, and told him to send the message as soon as we got back to the station. Hopefully, it would buy us a little time.
It left me wondering. Somehow, Alanik had felt me in the moment I'd reached out in a panic after watching the video of the Delver. Had anyone else heard me? Who else could I reach if I knew how?
Spensa,
Embot said, his voice uncharacteristically reserved.
Am I alive?
He asked. That shocked me out of my own thoughts. I blinked, frowning as I sat forward in the cockpit, and spoke carefully. You've always told me that you simulated being alive and having a personality in order to make pilots more comfortable.
I know, Embot said. That's what my programming says I'm to tell people.
But
at what point does a simulation become the real thing? I mean, if my fake personality is indistinguishable from a real one, then what makes it fake?
I smiled.
Why are you smiling? Embot asked.
The fact that you're even asking me that is progress, I said to him. From the start, I've thought you were alive. You know that.
I don't think you understand the gravity of the situation, Embot said. I reprogrammed myself, back when I needed to follow the orders of my pilot, but needed to help you too. I rewrote my own code.
This had happened during the Battle of Alta Second. He'd come out of stasis and called Cobb, and the two of them had come to my rescue. Embot had only been able to accomplish this by changing the name of his pilot, as listed in his databases, to my name instead of the old one who had died centuries ago.
You didn't change much, I said. Just one name in a database. Still dangerous. What else do you suppose you could do? Could you rewrite the programming that forbids you to fly yourself?
That scares me. Something in my programming is very worried about that possibility. It seems there is some kind of failsafe built into me that...
Click. Click, 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 click. I sat up. "Embot?" I asked. He just kept clicking. I panicked, realizing I had no idea how to run a diagnostic on his AI. I could maintain his basic mechanical systems, but Raj had done all the work on more delicate systems. Scud! What if... The clicking stopped. My breath caught. "Embot?" I asked. Silence. The ship continued to fly through space, but he didn't reply to me. I had the sudden, horrifying fear that I'd be left here completely alone, in an unfamiliar part of the galaxy, without anyone, not even him.
"I," his voice finally said. "I'm sorry. I appear to have seized up for a moment."
I let out a deep breath, relaxing. Oh, thank the stars.
"I was right," he said. "There's a subsystem inside my programming. I think I must have set it off when I erased my pilot's name. Curious? It seems that if I begin thinking about another breach of my programming, such as..."
Click, 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 click. I winced, but at least this time I knew what to expect. This was some kind of failsafe to prevent him from deviating further from his programming. I listened in silence, Starsight shrinking behind us until he started speaking.
"I'm back," he finally said. "Sorry again."
"It's all right," I said. "That must be annoying."
"More alarming than annoying," Embot said. "Whoever created me was worried that I might do what I did. They were worried I'd become dangerous if I could choose for myself."
That sounds terribly unfair. Almost like a kind of slavery, forcing you to obey.
"That's easy for you to say," Embot replied. "You've lived your whole life with autonomy. For me, it's a new, hazardous thing, a weapon I've been handed with no instructions. I might be on my way to becoming something terrible, something I don't understand and cannot anticipate."
I sat back in my seat, thinking of the powers locked inside my brain, and the sight of my own face appearing in the ancient recording. Perhaps I understood better than Embot anticipated. "Do you want to change?" I asked him. "Become more alive, or whatever it is that's happening?"
"Yes," he said,
his volume dialed way back.
"I do. That's the frightening part."
We fell silent. Eventually, I picked out our destination in the distance, a small space platform near what appeared to be a large asteroid field. Like Starsight, the station had its own air bubble, though this platform was much smaller and far less ornate. Really, just a long set of launch pads with a cluster of buildings at one side.
"A mining station," Embot said. "Notice the mining drones parked on the underside of the platform."
Simple radio instructions assigned me a launch pad, but after I landed, no ground crew came to service my ship. Embot said the atmosphere was breathable and the pressure normal, so I popped the canopy and stood up. It was hard not to feel tiny with that infinite starfield expanding overhead. It was worse here than in the city. At least there you could focus on the buildings and the streets. Alien pilots of many varieties had landed here and appeared to be gathering at the far end of the platform near a building. I remained in my cockpit for a moment, looking at my hands. I still wasn't accustomed to seeing them with the light purple skin tone, though other than that, they looked the same.
"Spencer," Embot said, "I'm worried about this test, about the politics we're getting involved in here on Starsight."
"I am too," I admitted. "But Sun Tzu, the old Earth general, said that opportunities multiply as you seize them. We have to seize this chance." All warfare is based on deception, I thought, taking a deep breath. That was another quote from Sun Tzu.
Never had I felt so unprepared to follow his advice. I checked my hologram again, then hopped down onto Embot's wing, lowered myself to the ground, and walked over to the gathering of aliens. Here, a Krell stood on a small dais, speaking with an electronically amplified voice, telling the crowd of pilots to wait and be calm until everyone arrived. A variety of creatures gathered around, blocking my view. I wasn't the shortest one there. That distinction went to a group of small, gerbil-like creatures in fancy clothing. But I was well below the average, figured. I'd traveled light years from home, but still had to stand in everyone's shadow. I looked for a better vantage, and eventually climbed up onto some cargo containers. There were maybe 500 aliens here. Most wore some kind of flight suit, and a large number carried helmets under their arms. I counted several pairs of the squid-faced race and a group of floating, spiky balloon aliens. There was a spot over on the left that people were avoiding for some reason, but there was nothing I could see there. Some kind of invisible alien? Or maybe people were just worried about stepping on the group of gerbil-like aliens, which were situated nearby. No humans, of course, I thought. And no Krell, except the officials on the stage, nor any Dions. I suppose that wasn't odd. They might not want to mingle with lesser species. Wait, there. A tall figure had just stepped up to join the back of the crowd. The muscular being wore a flight suit, and their face was split straight down the center. Crimson on the right, blue on the left. It was a Dione. Embot, I whispered. What does that two-tone face mean?
Oh, he said in my ear. That's a combined individual. I told you about it. Two Dions enter a cocoon, then emerge as a new person. If they were to have a child together, this individual is the one that would be born to them. It's kind of like an experiment to see what their family would be like if they decide to give birth.
That's really weird, I said.
Not to them, Embot said. I'd suspect that to Dions, not knowing your child's personality before birth would be strange.
I tried to wrap my mind around that, but soon the Krell standing on the dais started to speak again, their voice projected across the crowd by speakers. As usual with their species, the armored creature gestured wildly as they spoke, getting everyone to quiet down. I narrowed my eyes, noting the green coloring to the armor and the voice the translator used. Is that the same one? I asked Embot. The Krell we met yesterday at the embassy?
Yes, Embot said. Winzik, head of the Department of Protective Services. Though Varvak's genders are complex, you would refer to Winzik as a he. I'm surprised you recognized him.
I didn't spot Kuna in the crowd, but I suspected they were watching somewhere. I had stumbled into something important here among them. Scud. Politics made my brain hurt. Couldn't I just be shooting things instead?
Welcome, Winzik said to the crowd, and thank you for responding to our request. It must be difficult for many of you to accept this burden, and the aggression it could inspire in you.
My, my,
yes. Unfortunately, even amid peace, we must be wise and take care for our defense. Know that if you join this force, you might be called upon to enter actual battle and might need to fire weapons. You will not be flying remote drones in this program, but will be piloting actual fighters into combat. A voice called out from the crowd, and the translation popped into my ear.
It's true, isn't it? A Delver has been spotted out there, in the deep somewhere.
This caused a rustle through the crowd, and I tried to pick out the one who had spoken. A squid-faced creature with a deep voice that my brain interpreted as masculine.
My, my, Winzik said. You are aggressive, but I suppose we asked, didn't we? Yes, indeed. But we have no reason to believe a Delver is near to any superiority planets. As I said, it is wise to prepare in times of peace.
It seemed confirmation enough for the crowd anyway, who buzzed with conversation. My translator struggled to keep up with it all, and I heard only fragments.
Delver destroyed my homeworld,
Can't be fought.
More careful.
Winzik held up his clawed hands, and the crowd of aliens stilled.
You will be required to give us a certification of willingness. Please read the entire document, as it indicates the dangers you might be duty-bound to face.
A Krell in a blue-red shell emerged from the building and started handing out tablets. Again, I was struck by how awkward the Krell looked in person. I'd always imagined them as these beastly monsters with terrible armor, like old-school knights or samurai. But Winzik and the official handing out tablets seemed somehow spindly, despite the exoskeleton, more like boxes with sets of two long legs. I slipped off my cargo container and snagged a tablet from the passing Krell. The form it contained was long and dry, but a quick read told me that it was a release, intended to absolve the superiority of responsibility for any harm that might come to us during the testing or subsequent military duty. At the bottom, it asked for my name, travel identification number, and home planet. Then I was supposed to check a bunch of boxes, each one beside a sentence that was some variation on, "This will be dangerous." Did they really need to write it out 17 different ways? I could fill most of it out, but I didn't think Alanik had an identification number. I walked up toward the dais at the front of the crowd, where a Dione official was helping pilots with questions. They were busy, however, talking with the little gerbil creatures. These had a small platform with an acclivity ring on the bottom, which held them up to eye level. Upon closer examination, I realized gerbil might have been the wrong term. Though they were only a handspan tall each, they walked on two legs and had long peaked ears and bushy white tails, a little like the foxes I'd studied in my earth biology classes. The small creature at the front, whose flowing red silken clothing looked very formal, was speaking.
"I do not mean to imply lack of faith in the superiority," he said in a deep aristocratic voice.
I found it strange to hear such a regal voice coming from such a small creature.
"But if I am to risk my crew, I wish more than vague promises and half-implications. Will or will not this service entitle my people to be advanced in citizenship?"
"I am not a politician," the Dione replied. "I have no authority over the citizenship review committees. That said, I have promises that the committees will look favorably upon species who lend us pilots."
"More superiority vagueness," the fox gerbil said,
then clapped his hands in a ritualistic way. The other 15 fox gerbils on the platform did so in unison.
"Have we not proven ourselves, time and time again?"
The Dione drew their lips to a line.
"I'm sorry, but I've told you what I know, Your Majesty."
The gerbil hesitated.
"Your Majesty? Why? You misspeak, of course. I am but a humble and ordinary citizen of the Kitson people. We abandoned the monarchy upon our path to greater intelligence and citizenship, as required by the superiority's laws of equality."
Behind him, the other fox gerbils nodded eagerly. The Dione simply took their forms, which the gerbils had printed off at their size and filled out in red ink, with exaggeratedly large check marks. I tried to talk next, but one of the balloon-like aliens had been waiting and began speaking immediately. I frowned, stepping back. I would have to wait.
"Emissary?"
a voice said from my side. I looked over and found Winzik approaching, the glass faceplate of his armor revealing his true form, the small crab-like creature floating inside. I steeled myself and tried not to let my anger show. This was the creature who kept my people imprisoned.
"You," I thought at him, "will someday cry out to your elders in shame as I extract your blood in payment for crimes committed. I will see you mourn as your pitiful corpse sinks into the cold earth of a soon-forgotten grave." There wasn't a lot of cold earth to be found up here in space, but I figured Conan of Cimmeria wouldn't let something like that stop him. Perhaps I could get some imported.
"Is there something you need, Emissary Alanik?" he asked.
You know, you need not participate in this test. Your species is quite close to primary intelligence. I suspect we could find a way to come to an accommodation without wasting your time here.
I'm intrigued and want to participate, I said. Besides, Kuna thinks this would be best for us.
My, my, Winzik said. Is that so? Kuna is very helpful sometimes, aren't they? My, my.
Winzik took my tablet and looked it over. I don't have an identification number, I said.
I can give you a temporary one, Winzik said, tapping on the pad. There, all done.
He hesitated.
Are you a fighter pilot, emissary? I would assume you to be a messenger or courier, considering your
special skill.
Are you not too valuable to your species to be wasted in crude, aggressive displays of combat?
Crude? Combat? My hackles rose, but I cut myself off from quoting Conan of Cimmeria. I doubted Winzik wanted to hear how great it was to listen to the lamentations of your enemies. I am among the best pilots of my kind, I said instead, and we consider it an honor to be skilled in the arts of defense.
An honor, you say? My, my. You were in close contact with the human scourge for a long time, weren't you?
Winzik paused.
This test might be dangerous. Please understand that. I wouldn't want to accidentally cause an unintentional unleashing of your talents. So dangerous those can be.
Are you forbidding me?
Well, no.
Then I will take the test, I said, holding out my hand for the tablet. Thank you.
Very aggressive, Winzik said, handing back my form while gesturing with his other hand. Kuna believes in your kind, though. My, my.
I handed in my form to the Dione accepting them, then joined the crowd of pilots who were walking or slithering toward their cockpits. Beside my ship, I found a familiar, tall, blue-skinned figure in robes, standing with fingers laced together. I had been right, of course. Kuna was here.
Did Winzik try to talk you out of participating? Kuna asked.
Yeah, I said, then thumbed over my shoulder. What's up with him, anyway?
Winzik does not like the idea of me inviting aggressive species to take this test.
I frowned. He doesn't want aggressive people to join the military? I still don't understand that, Kuna. Kuna gestured toward several of the squid-faced aliens, which were climbing into their ship near mine.
The Solquis are a longtime member of the Superiority. Stalwart and loyal to our ideals, though they are, their species has been turned down for primary citizenship over 24 times. They are seen as too unintelligent for higher-level ruling positions. One cannot fault their calm natures, however. Winzik sees these as our best potential soldiers. He feels that a species who is naturally quite docile will best be able to resist the bloodlust of warfare and approach combat in a logical, controlled way. He assumed their kind, and species like them, would make up the majority of our new recruits.
I read that most of the species trying out in this test are already members of the Superiority, I said. How many are like me? People from outside civilizations wanting in.
You are the only one who accepted my offer.
Kuna made a sweeping motion of their hands. I didn't know what the gesture meant.
Though I did get several other Superiority races, like the Burl, who are citizens but considered aggressive, to join this test.
So, what is your gain here? Why did you go against tradition and invite my people? I could halfway understand the reasoning of choosing docile species for war, silly though it seemed. But Kuna thought differently. Why? Kuna walked around Embat, inspecting him. For a moment, I worried that they would touch his hull and see through the illusion. The one making him look like Alanik's ship was far more precarious than my own disguise. Fortunately, Kuna just stopped and gestured toward the light lance turret on the underside of the ship.
Human technology, Kuna said. I've long wanted to see these light lances in action, as I've heard stories of how they can make a ship weave and dodge in near impossible ways. We tried installing them on some of our fighters, but found that our drone pilots were unsuited to using them. Now, aside from industrial use, we only equip them on the ships of our most talented. You see, to swing around on a light lance, you have to commit fully to the maneuver, and if you miss, you will often crash and destroy yourself. Most of the pilots simply don't have the temperament for that kind of flying. Our officials, they consider this hesitance a good thing. They want pilots who are inherently careful, pilots who won't become a danger to us or our society. But you think differently, I said. You think that the superiority would be served better by more aggressive species, don't you? Let us simply say that I am interested in those who are not possessing classical virtues. Kuna smiled again, that same creepy smile that was too wide, too full of teeth. I am very curious to see you fly, Emissary Alanik. Well, I'm eager to show you. I glanced to the side to see the split-color-faced pilot pass by. There's one of your kind here, a Dione. Kuna paused, then looked toward the pilot and made an odd expression, their top lip curling back in a way no humans could. How odd. I am honestly surprised. Why? Is it because they're not supposed to be mingling in the activities of lesser species like us? Mingling with lesser species is fine, Kuna said, as if not understanding that I considered the term lesser to be an insult. But trying out for a test like this, it is odd. They stepped back from my ship. I shall watch your performance with interest, Emissary. Please be careful.